really interesting reading, but I kind of did a double take at one point, because he's talking about Isaac Newton, and he referred to Newton pulling the cloak of positivism over, you know, over his work, basically. And that kind of struck me, because positivism as a philosophy wasn't actually developed until the early part of the 19th century. And so positivism is something that's been of interest to me, because it's really like embedded in modern philosophy, and particularly in the way that people look at and do science. So, you know, I really wanted to get a better understanding of what was going on there, and I did a little research, and I thought I'd tell you about what I came up with. So yeah, it's true that, you know, positivism, which, let me just give you a definition. The OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, briefly describes positivism as something that only, basically a philosophical position, that only recognizes observable phenomena and empirically verifiable scientific facts and laws. And so positivism was developed by a guy named Auguste Comte in the early half of the 19th century, as I said. And he was trying to come up with a philosophy that could be exact, that could really exactly describe philosophy. And he came up with some particular things, including formulations that refer to the exact sciences as the only source of knowledge, of real accurate knowledge. And he also came up with an understanding from his standpoint of the historical development of different stages of knowledge. And so he basically felt that knowledge went through three stages: the theological, the metaphysical, and the positive. And in the theological stage, basically people are trying to understand the primary and the final causes of phenomena. And we'll obviously be talking about final causes today. We did some reading about that. But people who are in this first or theological stage, according to Kant, they explain the apparent anomalies in the universe as interventions of supernatural agents. So he's looking at theological and supernatural explanations. And what he felt was the second stage, the metaphysical stage, people are still trying to understand primary and final causes of phenomena. But instead of answering their question with supernatural agents, which, you know, you could kind of correlate to Gebser's mythic stage, where you've got gods, basically. But instead of answering their questions about primary and final causes with agents, they talk about abstract entities. And so that's, you know, pretty similar to the mental mutation. But when people reach the positive stage, which was, you know, basically like a qualitatively higher stage in Comte's scheme of things, when they reach the positive stage, the mind stops looking for causes of phenomena, and it limits itself strictly to laws governing them. So similarly, absolute notions are replaced by relative ones. And that's me interrupting my own presentation. Here, let me just... Sorry about that. I usually try to silence the ringer before class. I didn't do that today. So anyway, in the positive stage, people, you know, finally can reject the search for final for final causes. Well, I think that the historical outline that Comte came up with is not something that Newton would necessarily have thought of things in. You know, Newton wouldn't have necessarily thought of things in that way. But Newton, and I think really the whole scientific project from Newton's time on, and even, you know, starting with Copernicus and people like that, especially Galileo, really did reject any use of metaphysics. We've been talking about this stuff, but I want to also give a brief definition of metaphysics here, from the Oxford English Dictionary, which is So the OED refers to metaphysics as the branch of philosophy that deals with the first principles of things or reality, including questions about being, substance, time and space, causation, change, and identity. As Burke points out, Newton was really not into what he called hypotheses. He didn't really like things where he couldn't find a precise result through observation and usually with the help of measurement. And to me, that really corresponds to the heart of the what positivism is about. So even though there's a definite philosophy called positivism, there's sort of a positivist trend that really corresponds to modern science, basically, and is really sort of the natural philosophy of modern science. And so I think Burt was correct in using that term, even though it sort of threw me for a loop. But as he points out, even though the people who hold this are trying to do exact science, I would say, I don't know if Burt used this term, but I would say they're doing inexact philosophy. Because Burt points out that, you know what? You have metaphysical assumptions that you make, no matter what you're doing. No matter what, I think the best example of that is Newton assumed God started everything. Well, what's God? I mean, and if you don't examine, or another thing is that he referred to, the universe as the sensorium of God. Again, if you've got God in your system, which was later, as Eric points out in one of these chapters, I don't know if it was this chapter or one before. Yeah, it was in chapter 5. At a certain point, science moved beyond deism. God was like not okay. Okay, so you have to have something more abstract than that. But still, you've got to have an understanding of what the metaphysical assumptions are that allow you for that. In the case of modern science, it was gravitation, which was, as Eric points out, action at a distance, which was not allowed in Newton's system. So you've got these metaphysical assumptions that are in your system, but you haven't examined them. And this has come up in several lectures this time and also in the previous classes. It's like, you're not really being very exact in your philosophy. And because of that, you're trapped in the assumptions that you yourself have taken on without examining them. So that's a real serious problem with positivism. I just felt that Burt was really correct in using that term. It's a good way of characterizing a whole trend in philosophical thought that, again, pairs itself very tightly with modern science. So that's basically what I came up with. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. Otherwise, just keep going. Okay. All right. Well, thanks.
Thank you. Great.
Yeah.
That was actually very helpful, and I really appreciate it. And what I got as I was listening to you was that the way you said it, so those three stages really laid them out so beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. And so in a certain sense, at the third stage, people give up on intellectual explanation, or all the things that we usually think of as intellectual explanation, and simply settle for observed correlations among scientifically observed phenomena. And then they call it a philosophy. Right? And so what's really interesting, Richard said it so beautifully, is that when you talk to scientists, they will claim that they are making no metaphysical assumptions. And yet, it's obvious that everything they say is metaphysically saturated. So there's a certain way in which I experience positivism as being in bad faith. It's really interesting. Yeah.
If positivism sort of sees itself as a move beyond metaphysics, then how do they interpret what a metaphysical claim is?
It's an empty illusion. Richard, help me on this, but I've heard them claim that any statement that can't be translated into an observation is mere nonsense. Flautus vocus, right? Empty words. Then they claim that any metaphysical speculation is simply a misuse of language, because language is capable of saying things that have no meaning.
Another way of putting this, that I'm not sure people would use as terms, but in a sense, that it's an attempt to create context when there is no context. That's how I think a positivist would say. Well, there's this term, context-free grammar, that's used in computer science, and it comes from the work of Chomsky in linguistics. But one of the problems with our modern worldview is that it really is not—it's not contextual.
Yeah.
And some philosophers have really tried to recontextualize modern life. You know, they've tried to recontextualize.
Well, what would be a context?
So to me, it's like if your system requires God or gravitation, and you don't understand what those are, then you have decontextualized the system inappropriately. But looking at it from their standpoint, people who hold the various forms of positivism would say that metaphysics is an inappropriate contextualization, I think.
That's right.
You know, and so it's like to them, it's like, no, context is like, I mean, some almost like a four-year-old that's playing with marbles or jacks or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And you try to inject the bigger world, and it's, no, we're playing jacks here. What's this about, you know, I don't know, like something bigger than that. You can't see beyond that because the jacks or the marbles are the concrete thing.
Yeah.
And everything else is like irrelevant.
It's an attitude.
Right? Yeah, basically it's an attitude. Yeah.
It's an anti-intellectual attitude.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not really an advance. I see it as a retreat, right? Instead of it as an advance.
Except that decontextualization allows a focus that is very powerful, and powerful enough to destroy the biosphere. But so, I mean, you know, that's kind of like it's not an advance, but yet you can see its attraction. It's very alluring because it allows you to do stuff that people really couldn't do before.
Yeah, so it's very interesting that we these possibilities open up that have drama and power, and if we pursue them uncritically, they generally become destructive. Right? And so this is part of what it means to say we're the deficient mental, is that we've lost track of the whole. And so we think if we can do any extreme thing, we might as well do it, because why not? Because we have no sense of the integrity of a whole that can be destroyed by an excessive movement in any single direction. There's no respect for the wholeness. When you get into positivism, you lose respect for the wholeness and the integrity of things, and everything just becomes observable relations that you can manipulate the hell out of because there's no context. Right? So, you know, I had an experience I wanted to share with you. I made contact with a really old friend of mine. This is a woman I met when I was 19, and she was 19 and I was 22 or 23 back in New York. And I hadn't talked to her about 10 or 15 years. We got together on Skype the other day. And we were talking about our early days when we got together, right? So when I met her, she was like 19. She was a student at NYU. She was completely depressed, totally nihilistic, you know. The last boyfriend she had used to sit on her and yell at her for hours, you know. And she was just kind of this weird creature, right? So, but I liked her, really bright. So we started living together, actually. And I had just become a Buddhist. Right, so I was getting really into her negativity, and I'd say, oh yeah, things are really shit, nothing makes any sense, but then if we take that one step further, it becomes emptiness, right? So I was sort of playing that game with her, right? So one day, we're sitting on the bed, and I was reading to her out of The Jewel Ornament of Liberation by Gampopa, and she suddenly looked at me with this completely stricken look on her face, and she said, I can no longer believe that that's not true. So she got it, right? Like suddenly the truth of the Buddha's teachings hit her. She had a conversion experience in that moment. I remember it really vividly, right? Because her face was so stricken, you know? It was like she was coming out of some radical nihilistic defense into some kind of commitment to life at that moment. Right? So I'm talking to her over the weekend, and she's thanking me for this. She's saying, you know, I owe you a debt of gratitude I can never repay because you sort of brought me into my world. She's living in Europe. She's a full-time Buddhist teacher, right? That's become her life, right? Meanwhile, I 4 or 5 years after that, I burned through Buddhism, and now I'm an ex-Buddhist, right? But she's still there, right? So it's really an interesting experience, you know, to sort of have that conversation and to remember that moment in which, in a certain sense, her world went from chaos to cosmos at that moment. And I've seen a lot of people have that experience around Brian. Right? People who are sort of, you know, they go through a regular education, they go to high school and shit, and they have no clue what's going on. They're basically living in a kind of chaotic sense of just being here that's very sort of ordinary and interesting. And they read the universe story, they hear Brian speak, and suddenly they move from chaos to cosmos. It's a conversion experience, right? And so I've been spending a lot of time thinking about this conversion experience, and what does it mean? How does this work, right? Because obviously, my friend Sarah, before she had this conversion experience, she knew English. She was in college, right? And she was very bright. But she didn't have something else. She didn't have a story. She didn't have a meta-narrative. Right? And so there's some way in which moving from just language into a meta-narrative creates cosmos out of chaos. And once that happens to us, we tend to become very attached to whatever model it is that brought us out of chaos. Right? It's also like you find in psychology that people have certain adaptive patterns that are very compulsive. And very often you will find out that they evolve those compulsive patterns as a way of dealing with a traumatic challenge, right? So, you know, somebody's very aggressive. Well, they decided when they were 4 years old to always go on the attack because that worked with their father or something, right? And so, like that. So in order for someone to give up that behavior, the reason they're so scared is because it feels like giving up the solution means sinking back into the traumatic problem. So in the same way, whenever any one of us gets a meta-narrative that moves us from cosmos to chaos, from moving out of a painful, bewildered situation into a situation that feels a lot better and more open and more coherent, right? And we don't want to go back into the confusion again, and so we latch on to our story. Now then, what's interesting is in order to hold on to the story, we have to begin working to maintain it. And we do that by finding ways of invalidating all the challenges that come along. Right? So to go back to this positivist example, right? People at the beginning of the 1900s, they're really confused. It's a very confusing time in history. Right? In mathematics, all the certainties are breaking down at that point. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of this sort of modern... The beginning of the breakdown of the mental is already happening there at the beginning of the 1800s. And so people freak out and rush back into some kind of simplified clarity. It's like, okay, this whole thing that's happening is too bewildering. So let's just go back to science and let's just go back to mathematics. Let's just say this is what we know and everything else is just simply an illusion. Right? So you can see what happens, right? It's a convulsive contraction around something familiar, which is then supported by an elaborate doctrine which denies the significance of all the challenges. Right? So this pattern, right, this is what people do, psychologically and philosophically. We move back and forth from chaos to cosmos, and the move into cosmos always involves some sort of story, right? Either a mythic story or a mental philosophy or a scientific paradigm, right? But that's what moves us from cosmos to chaos. Right? So do you have anything to say about that? I mean, I just find that so fascinating and kind of odd and bewildering to realize that that's how we work. Yeah, Skylar.
That's why I'm really interested in initiation processes, because it embodies something more than just a conversation. It's an actual experience that people sometimes when things have broken down for them, they need to rebuild back up.
But that's right.
They need to have some sort of experience that's
beautiful.
That's going to allow them to do that in a healthy way.
That's so important, because this is one of the, what you're raising is one, I think, consequence of this that people don't take into account. What we don't take into account is that moving from chaos to cosmos is not just an intellectual operation. It's a profoundly emotional and bodily experience as well. Right? And so we act as if having an idea is just like picking up a token. So we should be able to just drop it if it's wrong. Right? But that's not true, because these ideas form our personality. And so really, when we talk to people and challenge their ideas, we have to be aware that we're challenging their psychological security. And if we want people to change from one idea to another, if they're willing, probably some kind of initiation ceremony would greatly facilitate it, because it would acknowledge the full dimensionality of this shift. So I really appreciate that, Scholar. Yeah.
Well, in that situation, that experience is kind of the oomph and the glue that gets you committed to a point where you're ready to endure the trials of the story, or for instance, like falling in love is what the energy keeps you together with a person even when the relationship becomes difficult.
Right.
The initiation process into a religious experience, when it comes time to really sit down and meditate, is painful.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me like in our modern culture, we don't have that. We can get that experience in so many different ways, and so we can jump from one system, one religion, one relationship to another very easily.
That's right.
Because we do want that experience, and so we never get the discipline of the coherent system, which if you follow all the way through, you get the actual answer. So we just have all these questions that partially
That's right, answer. Because we aren't committed enough not to go forward. Right?
And you talk about the commitment to being a philosopher and working and thinking and exercising the mind as a discipline and
That's
thinking
right.
through, and also being willing to come out the other end and say, you know, that doesn't make sense. I can't accept that.
That's it.
Being willing to burn through Buddhism, not just give up on it prematurely and
right.
go through another religious experience.
That's right.
Relationship.
That's right. Beautiful. Right? And that's actually the next thing I wanted to say. So thank you so much for saying it. Right? What I wanted to say was that being a philosopher is a shift in attitude whereby we recognize our own story as a story and push it to its very outer limits. And so instead of allowing ourselves to explain away the challenges, we dig right into the challenges. That's what it means to be a philosopher. Right? And when you do that, you will find that your story will eventually break. This is actually what happened to me as a Buddhist, right? I had become a Buddhist. I'd really, you know, teaching all over the country, you know, I read a lot of texts. I was a big hot shit Buddhist, right? Senior meditation instructor for Trungpa Rinpoche on the West Coast, you know, traveling all over like that, right? But then I decided I want to understand it better. So I went back to school to study Western philosophy to see how the two compared, right? And I started digging in, right? And also the other thing I did was that it was sort of a culty situation I was in, and so the whole people were sort of trying to repress doubts, right? So the idea was that if you doubted the guru, that meant you and neurotic, right? So there's all this kind of shit going on, right? And so what I did was, as people came into the program to learn, they have doubts, and I would take on their doubts completely. I'd say, okay, I'm not going to rest until I know exactly why this doubt makes sense. And then when I know that, I'm going to see if I can work my way back to the Dharma from there. I did it successfully for a long time, but then eventually I couldn't get back to Buddhism anymore. Right? Because my tests eventually destroyed it. It stopped holding me. And since then, I've been to two or three more of these things. Right? So these if we're a philosopher and we push our explanatory metaphor all the way to the end, to the edge, it will probably just be destroyed. And then we'll have to open up a new understanding, right? So it's the entering into that path, that's the philosophical path. And it's very much a spiritual path, right? Because with each one of these collapses of aha, you go back into the charnel ground, right? Back into the ground of creativity, back into the confusion, and have to come back out, right? With a new system, right? And so that, and each system then is deeper and more profound and more interesting than the one before. And now you eventually may get to a point where you want to go beyond doing that whole activity. I'm starting to feel something like that, right? But it's a path that goes somewhere. So I want to talk about that. Yeah?
I have a real favorite quote from Heraclitus. And it's not absolutely true, but there's a lot to it. He said that whoever cannot seek the unforeseen sees nothing, because the known way is an impasse. And
say
it's
it
like
again. Say it again. Beautiful.
Whoever cannot seek the unforeseen sees nothing, for the known way is an impasse. Sorry. But you know, it's like the
so
thing
beautiful.
Is that people partly hold on to stuff because it works. It gets them
That's
somewhere.
Right.
But then you're just going, you know, it's rectilinear. You're just going like this, because that's your known way.
Exactly.
You know?
Without a known way, we're lost. But if we don't look for the unexpected, we're lost also.
Yeah.
Michael.
Do we do we see chaos? Like, is it, I think the only way to make it a valid abstraction is to say that we actually see it in our reality. And I think, to actually be able to say that it is happening is then becomes a way of ordering it?
Sure. Listen, I'm not trying to make that fine a distinction. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm just saying that at the moment when we get a new understanding, looking back, it seems like we've been in a more or less chaotic situation. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to talk about the ontology of chaos.
I'm just talking to suggest that they run parallel. Chaos and order are always coming together.
Yeah, but see, what I want to say to you is that I'm speaking at a more superficial level, right? Like, I'm not talking about the fundamental aspects of chaos and cosmos. It's way out, that would be a whole other thing. All I'm saying, I'm making a psychological statement, not a philosophical statement.
No, I'm being very psychological.
Okay, so let me try it again.
Can we psychologically, can chaos be psychologized?
Let me ask you a different question. I'm trying to talk about the difference between what it's like before a meta-narrative and after a meta-narrative. Okay. Something happens, right? There's a kind of confused feeling.
The perception of chaos.
you want to call that chaos?
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you want to say about chaos? I'm not following you.
Well, here, look, can I try? Because I think I understand what you're getting at. Although I think I just lost it. Let me try. So basically, like, you're going through your life, like your friend, you know,
right.
She's got all this stuff going on, oh my God, ugh. And then you give her an explanation.
Right.
And so suddenly she can order all the chaos.
Right.
But I think what you're getting at is that now as you're going forward, there's still chaos around.
Absolutely.
And it tests the order that you've imposed.
Beautiful.
And you're trying to juggle that, and so one way of dealing with that is to just go for the order. And
that's
just
right.
Stay
that's
in that
right.
narrow, is that kind of what you're getting
exactly
at?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's the
yeah.
same thing I'm saying, so I get it.
that's what I
okay.
We got some order out of that.
Okay, thank you both. Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, and if you think about it sort of from a developmental structural perspective, often, you know, at the kind of altitude that we might associate with the mythic.
An attitude?
An altitude, kind of in terms of using a vertical developmental spectrum kind of metaphor. The sort of pre-conventional mode is very, very takes a sort of mythic meta-narrative and tends to have a concrete literal interpretation of it and is very, very attached to it. And it's not really open to evidence and to being tested. And so there's a kind of irrational clinging that happens, the filtering out of all anomalous data and so on. And then there can be, you know, there's the sort of deconstruction of meta-narratives that happens at a post-conventional level.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the space of deconstructing all meta-narratives, you have the nihilism that you were speaking about, in a sense. There's still not a sense of order, but there is a very sophisticated disposition that's relating to that. But there's a need for order.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really interesting. It's like, how do we be open to new evidence? How do we continue to push and test our meta-narrative without becoming overly attached to it? And I think that in a lot of what we see in the New Age is a regressive move back to a mythic meta-narrative and unconscious attachment to that. And so I think what you're saying is like super important because it's just not happening nearly enough as we like to see it happening.
Yeah,
you know, and I think it seeps in even to the best of us. To myself, I can see like the ways in which we go back and read these various spiritual meta-narratives and we're not really critically considering these things.
That's right.
And there is these unconscious psychological mechanisms that are at play in terms of why it is that we're so drawn to the philosophies that we're drawn to and how we hold them and the ways in which we engage them and critically analyze them or not.
And a lot of that, as you say, involves mythic regression and so forth. Absolutely,
exactly.
Yeah. That's well said. Yeah. Yeah.
So one just common sense ordered reality is that you look to me like this substance, this physical object, you're solid, you know, and that just, so to think about you and, as a process that's continually, right, is doesn't seem common sense in a certain aspect. It answers a lot of common sense, explains a lot of common sense issues. But I think that's the attraction to that way of thinking. It just seems...
To which way? To the positivist?
The positivist way of thinking. It just seems so obvious.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I just have to ask, what is the motivation behind the divine that wants to create the perception of reality that isn't what it is? It seems almost like the Maya, the illusion, the divine creates this illusion. And why are we motivated to see through the experience that's been created for us to enjoy? And do we get more enjoyment now? You know, we played the game so many times, now we want to know what the functions are that make the game interesting, the strategies, and, you know, we're no longer playing chess, we're analyzing what is chess
And what makes us do that?
And it takes you have to have played enough chess to where you're just bored with the game, and it's, you know, predictable, and you're like, okay, now can we do different variations, and can we see what's happening? There's just something about that you have to personally achieve a level of boredom with
Well, see, now you're asking a big metaphysical question. Huge. Right? Probably the most interesting one of all. Like, why do we fall into closed interpretations? Right? And then why do we come out of them? Right? Now, sure, Bindo's great on this, but I'm not going to go into all that. But I've been noticing, when I meditate, I'm really interested in concentration practices. And so I try to follow my breath really, really closely. And I also, lately, I've been doing it lying down, because I'm interested in seeing if I can hold my breath while my body's completely relaxed. Because I think that might help me sort of have out-of-body experiences. So I've been playing with that, right? So I lie in the bed, and I meditate. And I can follow my breath sometimes really well for 20 or 30 minutes, but a lot of times I can't, and then what will happen, I'll be following my breath, and then I'll wake up from a fantasy, right? And I don't notice the transition, right? And yet I can feel in myself, so I'm lying there and meditating, and I got my breath, and there are all these little germs of thoughts and fantasies that are constantly sort of coming in at me. You know what I'm talking about, right? And so I'm sitting there and saying, oh, not that one, not that one, not that one, back to the breath, not that one, not that one. So I'm doing this kind of, it's kind of fun, right? I do that for a long time. If I do that, I get very quiet. But then at some point, I give in to temptation, and one of those invitations comes along, and I give into it without even knowing I'm doing it, right? It's not like I decide to go into it, it just takes me over, right? So it's just really interesting to notice that moment between the lucid state, where I'm sort of noticing the fantasies as invitations that I can reject, and then the non-lucid state, in which I've already accepted the invitation and entered into a world. Right? Same thing happens, right, on a larger scale, like philosophically. Right? We can be all deconstructionist and skeptical, right? And yet there's this kind of need in us to go to sleep, in a sense, to enter into the cocoon of a fantasy. It's this huge gravitational attraction that pulls us in. Right? And we can imagine that gravitational attraction is an expression of the divine impulse to sleep, of the divine impulse to involute, to become simplified, to become material. Right? And then we have this other thing in us that keeps waking us up. Even when we're comfortable, it'll wake us up, because, like you say, we'll get bored. Right? Or there's this kind of impulse in us to go beyond what's known, like Heraclitus is talking about, right? To begin to expect the unexpected. Right? And this impulse is the evolutionary impulse in us, right? It's the soul. It's the other side of the involution. Right? So talking about this is really fun, right? But it gets us into this big metaphysical speculation if we go out there.
And the point of like a movie is to get you into that world. And so we're in a world, in a world.
That's right. There's something so relaxing about it, right? There's something that's so pleasant about just going to sleep and being carried.
Yeah.
Right? And yet, we know that we get in trouble when we do that. It's fun and it's relaxing, but of course it doesn't get us anywhere in our life. And so often it gets us into trouble because we get seduced by some fantasy and end up acting it out in a way that's ridiculous, right? So it's just really interesting, right? And it's very much the subject of our class, right?
right? Because the whole modern mental mutation is a way of going to sleep. And we're trying to wake up from it now. So we can go back to sleep in the integral and have to wake up from that, right? So it's like, you know, it's just that.
But the mental is used to wake up from
the mythic. But we have to wake up from the mental. See, the mental wakes up from the mythic, and then it itself becomes a closed system. And then this expectation for the unexpected, this boredom, this factor within us that's never quite satisfied, it's, I would say, is a hunger for our divine origin, pops us out again. So it's really interesting.
If we can refer to something like the divine origin, then why can't we just go ahead and make the metaphysical leap and say that this is a characteristic of reality, that it slips through forms? I mean, that's what our science is saying.
If you want to do that, sure. I mean, that's a valid metaphysical move. Sri Aurobindo makes it really well. We'll talk about that when we talk about Sri Aurobindo. I'm just, in this particular class, I'm focusing on a different level of things. I'm sort of interested in more of the science and the transphysical worlds, right? I'm not trying to do the whole, you know, involution and evolution. I'm just trying to do something a little more narrow, because I think it's important in its own, right? I'm engaging in self-limitation for the sake of the value that it reveals, just like God does, right? Okay? All right, so let's talk about causality. Unless anybody has something, anybody else want to say something? Okay, so obviously causality is a really important category. And when we discuss category, we're speaking about how it is that entities form and how it is that they relate to each other. Now, going back to Aristotle, we have the four causes, the material, efficient, and the formal, and the final. It's an enormous testament to Aristotle's genius that these categories are still so relevant. Right? Like there he was at the very beginning of the mental mutation, and so much of what he saw just turned out to be fundamental, right? And shaped thinking ever since. So thinking, knowing these causes and thinking in terms of them is itself a kind of mini philosophical initiation. So let's talk about what Aristotle meant. Right? So for Aristotle, what is the material cause? Did you guys read the chapter?
Substance.
Yeah. Substance. Exactly. Right. So now who wants to say what substance is for Aristotle? What are the characteristics that substance has for Aristotle?
Amorphous,
that's right. No form.
Yeah, underlying reality.
That's right.
That takes on forms.
That takes on form. And does it add anything else? Anybody? Individuality.
Oh. Atomistic.
Right? Well, not exactly atomistic. It's not an atomistic system, but the point is that substance, you know, this chalk is an individual thing. Right? And as an individual thing, it is formed by forms, right? So the form of chalkiness and the form of whiteness and the form of cylinder are all ingredients in this substance. But it is its own thing. And so the substance is that which individualizes it as its own thing. So substance is both formless and individualizing. That's what it accounts for. Now, this idea of substance as formless, can anybody explain how we get to that? Yeah.
Because substance is generic, and in order to get to the generic in Aristotle's way of looking at things, you have to remove categories.
Exactly.
And once you've removed all the damn categories, there's nothing left except something called substance.
Exactly, right? So if you take away the whiteness, you take away the chalkiness, you take away the cylindricalness, you take away the powderiness, what's left? Whatever it is, it doesn't have any form because we've removed all the forms in trying to get to it. Make sense? You get me? So for example, Newton, we get to in a minute, Newton talks about the atoms as the material cause. But Aristotle would say that's absurd because he would say, look, your atoms already have form. They have hardness, they have mass, they have position, right? They have a shape. And so if you want to find out the substance, you have to take all that away to see what substance is.
Right? So Aristotle's got something going on there, right? That makes a certain amount of sense. But anyway, this is how it was viewed. Now, how do substances come into being? Right? They come into being by, I said this the other day, by a process of definition. Right? So you take some blank substance and you add whiteness and chalkiness and powderiness and chalkiness and stuff, then you get this thing. Right? So the way it comes into being and the way we define it are parallel processes. The universe is fundamentally a rational place in which entities come into being by definition. Yes, Linda?
So does that mean that there is only one substance according to Aristotle?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. There's only one type of substance, and it does individualize. So whether he would say there are many substances or one, I have no clue. Someone must have to know Aristotle. Do you know that better than I do?
This is, in all his writings concerning these finer things, it has been quite uncertain because it is not certain whether how he distinguish between the basic substance, which could be similar to matter as such, and the substance which forms the basic substance of each individual.
Okay, so it's an ambiguous question. So that we don't know the answer in this room. In any case, we have to study Aristotle to figure that out. Good question. Okay. So formal cause, and then we have the efficient cause, and the efficient cause is like things banging into each other. It's sort of like science, right? It's like the way entities affect each other. And then the final cause is the purpose, the reason, why. So Aristotle would say, let's say we want to account for the existence of a house. This is the classic example. It's in the book, right? So the material cause are the construction materials, right? Wood and concrete and stuff. That's the material cause. The formal cause is the blueprint, the architect's blueprint. The final cause is to live in it. And the efficient cause are the carpenters. That's kind of clear, right? And something elegant about that. But then, this is really interesting. Aristotle says that we have to treat these all separately when we're dealing with an artifact or a manufactured or human-created object. But if we're talking about a self-created or a natural object, like either a rock or a snail or a plant or something that wasn't fabricated from the outside, then the efficient cause, the formal cause, and the final cause all collapse into the formal cause. Right? So for example, as a human being, my reason to exist, why Aristotle would say, is to express humanness, right? And the formal cause of my existence is the form of humanness that is ingressing into the substance of what I am. And the efficient cause is the form expressing itself in substance. Right? So you have all these three categories collapsing into the formal cause for Aristotle. And so the fantasy here is that the ideas are the dynamic factors in reality. Substance is passive. Ideas are dynamic, right? And so the ideas express themselves in substance, and that's what makes things happen, right? Is forms expressing themselves in substance. So consciousness isn't even separated out here as a separate factor. But it seems to have something to do with the operation of form, right? Because intelligence is clearly associated with form and not with matter or substance. Okay.
Eric, is that because living things have like the living part of them is what is this efficient and final aspect to them? That's like
for Aristotle, that living part is the formal part.
So the non-living things, there's something about their forms that are dead and something about living things where the form's alive?
No, because obviously the particular materials, like alive and dead, I don't think Aristotle would ever think of anything as dead.
Okay.
There's no such thing as dead.
Natural and
artificial.
Artificial.
Right, so in a house, each piece of wood, each piece of brick
is natural.
Unless it's already been formed, right? So the point is, it's a crude distinction.
No, but we...
Yeah. But the point is that clearly, if we take something that human beings have made, an artifact, then we have to separate out all these three. But in a natural being, they seem to function together, and Aristotle is saying that it's the formal element that functions as efficient and final cause.
So that must mean that if there's something artificial that like a person puts together, that there's those things are together in the person that's doing it. So the living form's active in the person.
That's right.
But then we need the other causes from other places.
That's what I was saying. If I'm creating a house, the final cause doesn't reside in the house, it resides in me.
Yeah.
Right? So the final cause is exterior to the house, and the efficient cause is exterior to the house because it's the carpenters, right? And the formal cause is exterior, it's the blueprint. But in an organism, that's all together. The final cause is the final cause of the organism, right? Which is the formal cause, which is the efficient cause for Aristotle.
So I have to think, I'm going to apply this to Whitehead's internal relations, external relations, and not go into it now, but that's something that I want to think about.
Yeah, well, basically, once, that's a good thought, and one point I'll mention is that in this way of thinking, because each usia, each individual being is separate, all relations between them are external. So that's what be one aspect of the exploration. Okay, yes, Linda.
It seems like that would also relate to the internally versus externally related systems, relate to the subjective aim being able to be shared among all the occasions that are in an internally related system, where that formal cause collapses. Those three collapse into the one.
Okay, the first thing you said was really, really, really interesting and right, and then I lost this transition to the second
point. The internally related systems, the ones in which the three later causes collapse into just the formal cause.
Right.
It sounds to me like that's the kind of system in which the subjective aim would be shared among all the parts.
That sounds right. I have to think it through, but it really sounds right. It's a very promising thought. I really like it. But you'll notice, for Whitehead, when they all collapse, they don't collapse into the formal, they collapse into the efficient. So it's different. We'll get to that. Okay, now, let's talk about Newton. So there's big discontinuity here, right? Like going from the ancient world to the modern world. In the book called The Nature of Physical Existence, by Ivor Leclerc, this is an amazing book, just amazing. He goes through and talks about theories of matter, the nature of physical existence, going all the way back to Aristotle, all the way through the Middle Ages, all the way up to Newton and beyond. And it's just fascinating. So what I'm giving you is a very thin and abstract sketch of what he spells out elegantly in that book. Okay, so we have this big discontinuity coming into the modern world. And through a whole very complex process, the material cause is now atoms. So the material, now the substance of things is no longer formless and individualizing. The substance of things are individual entities that are already and always formed. Right? So now we see that some of the formal cause has ended up being put into the material cause category here. See that? Right? Because the atoms already have form. And then the efficient cause... there are two different stages of that. For Aristotle, the efficient cause is just God, period. But once people don't like that anymore and start giving the atoms gravitational fields, then the efficient cause becomes other atoms. Right? And then the formal cause becomes natural law. Now this is interesting, right? Because as Newton first conceives natural law, it's completely external, right? Because the atoms are self-existent and completely passive, and so whatever happens to them has to be caused from outside. Later on, we begin to assign some immanent causality to the atoms by giving them gravitational fields and so forth. But still, we imagine that even these apparently internal relations, like gravitational interactions, are governed by this external
transcendent, immutable scheme of lawfulness. And so all the formal cause, which for Aristotle belonged to each individual entity, is now taken from the entity and moved up into this abstract realm of natural law. That's where the formal cause is. And then for Aristotle, there simply is no final cause. Except God's. For Newton, there's still final cause, it's God's. And after Newton, there's simply final cause is written out of reality. It's at the moment when the final cause of things is written out that the universe becomes a meaningless hurrying of atoms. Because all purpose is now devoid, left. The universe has no purpose for existing, and no entities have any purpose for existing. There's no value, it's all just vacuous. Right, so this is how these laws get, these forms of causation get transformed in the modern world. And we've been living with this understanding of causation. And in Newton, all the energy is on the efficient cause. And that's where all the action is. In science, the word cause just means efficient cause. And all the other meanings are either suppressed or repressed. So final cause is repressed, and formal cause is suppressed and reappears in the form of natural law. Make sense? So now we come to process metaphysics, which then is a new epoch, right? So this would be, if I'm right, this is the efficient mental. And this is the deficient mental. And maybe this is the integral. That's what I'm hoping. Okay. So, in process metaphysics, the material cause becomes creativity. And in fact, Whitehead explicitly says at the beginning of Process and Reality that his category of creativity replaces Aristotle's category of substance. So what is creativity? Anybody remember what creativity is? How did Whitehead define creativity? Have we talked about that? Okay, creativity, in Whitehead's famous definition, is the process through which the many become one and are increased by one. Right, so, first of all, we have to notice that creativity is not a substance, and it's not a thing. It's a recursive process. Those of you who know computer science will be familiar with the term recursive. Basically, a recursive function is a function that can take its own output as a further input, and so it goes around and around that way. Right? So, creativity takes as its input the multiplicity of actual occasions of the past, unifies them into a new drop of experience, and then adds that drop of experience to the pool that will then be unified.
It's very mysterious.
Oh, of course. It's, you know, the metaphysical first principle is always mysterious. That's the whole point, right? I mean, you try to explain everything you can explain, and then what's left over that's too mysterious to contemplate, you name it the first principle. That's how you do it in metaphysics. Yeah.
But that's like, this creativity process, I mean, like, why does it choose what it chooses?
Well, Whitehead says a lot about that, right? And the way to get at the mystery of creativity is to notice its operation as ourselves, moment to moment, right? So the process of existence through which I become present in this room involves moment to moment the unification of the past in a new experience and the articulation of this experience as something to be unified by the future. Right? So creativity is what we do. Right? In Sri Aurobindo's language, creativity is the expression of Satchidananda. But it's what we are. Creativity is what we are. I am not a substance. I know that, right? Because I do not endure unchanging like a thing. I am an ongoing dynamic process. And it is clear to me that in every moment of my process, I take into account what has gone before, I elaborate possibilities and I decide among them, thus becoming an actuality for you. And then you become an actuality for me. Right? So this is creativity. And on the one hand, it's very mysterious, but on the other hand, it's the most obvious thing in the world. Because it's what we are. It's a way of naming what we are and how we function. Right? So the attention here is shifting. See, to even say what I am or what we are is already mental language. It already has a certain substantiality implicit in it. What I am already calls for an answer in terms of substance. Right? So I should say how I function. Because how I function in process thought is what I am. I am a function. I am functioning. I'm not existing in the old sense like a thing. I am a dynamic function, self-created in time. Right? So this is creativity. Right? So it's not quite that mysterious. I mean, it's got a really nice intuitive grounding for it. Really much more so than substance. I mean, when you think about substance, it's just... It shows up as kind of an annoying logical necessity, right? I try to analyze what something is, and then I get all its properties, and I know that no matter how many properties I name, something is left over, right? And so there's an assumption that's substance, right? But of course, that assumption is basically a metaphysical hypothesis that is not justified. And what Whitehead will say is that the notion of substance is too abstract. Right, so that if we observe a society of actual occasions such as this, and we step back from it, we can name it a substance because it has for us certain substantial properties. It endures through time. But to claim that as its ontological essence is to commit an error, because essentially everything is a temporal process, not a static thing. Okay, creativity, right? So creativity now... I mean, compare creativity to atoms and think about the potential, right? The richness, the sense of like how much more it is and how much more intimate with us it is than the atoms are or the substances, right? So this, I can claim this is a big advance, right? Because creativity, see, if we think that the world consists of atoms, well, this is a dead place, right? If you think of the world consists of atoms, and you think of time and change as being nothing but the rearrangement of the atoms, it's a very closed system, like Heraclitus would say, right? All you can get out of a collection of moving atoms is a collection of moving atoms. It doesn't go anywhere, right? But creativity brings forth novelty, experience, purpose, and life into the universe in an ongoing way. So it's much more concrete and much more full. Okay, now, the formal cause, let's talk about that next. The formal cause, let me start the way up here. The formal cause is, I would say, in process metaphysics, the formal cause of a new actual occasion is the array of possibilities that are actually available to it. Right? So I come into being, I register the past, and because the past is the way it was, and because any decision I make must be logically consistent with the past having been the way it was, at any given moment, there's a finite range of possibilities that open up for me. And I will become actual as I reduce those possibilities through a process of decision to one actuality, right? And so I'm claiming that in process metaphysics, that array of possibilities is the formal cause of the occasion. It represents the forms that that occasion might take, right? So when you look at it that way, you realize that every entity in the universe has its own final formal cause. Right? The formal cause for any concressing actuality is unique and never to be repeated. Now, what does that do to natural law? Because natural law assumes that there's one and only one natural law, which implies impartially, and that's the formal cause, right? One formal cause implies impartially to all actualities. I'm claiming, on the contrary, that each entity has its own individual formal cause. So how do I reconcile those two? And it's very simple, because if I take a collection of low-grade actual entities, which are sufficiently similar to each other, I can treat them as if they're governed by a single natural law. Right? So the idea of natural law becomes a special case of the process analysis of formal cause. Okay.
Array of possibilities. Words have so many more letters when you have to write them on the board.
Okay.
Can I just ask quickly?
Yes, please.
When you use the word entity, it's different than saying occasions, which are the foundational elements, or is it? What do you mean?
Well, I use the word entity when I don't want to use the word thing. So
you don't want to say occasion? It's not the same.
In some cases it is, in some cases it isn't. I will also use the word entity to refer to eternal objects. So I use the word entity. I use the word entity as a generalized term for something I want to talk about that I don't want to ascribe any ontological status to. So anything I can individualize and talk about is an entity. Okay. Right? So, but often it means occasion. You have to tell by context what I mean.
Right.
So the word entity could mean eternal object, or it could mean actual occasion, and you'll have to use your judgment to discern from context. Which one? Okay. Okay, now the efficient cause. Okay, the efficient cause, sort of like Aristotle, the efficient cause is other actual occasions. But there's a huge difference here. Because atoms are, the nature of atoms is exhausted by their mathematical description. Those are the only properties an atom have, or mathematical properties. Whereas on the other hand, an actual occasion, while it can have mathematical properties, is also purposeful, conscious, valuing, feeling, right? Processing, concressing, right? So the nature of the fundamental units of the fundamental units that are exercising causal agency is much, much richer in process metaphysics than it is in Newtonian mechanics. Right? Make sense? We'll come back to that in a minute. Right? And then finally, the final cause enters in, and every actual occasion has its own final cause. I'm just going to call it final cause here. And of course, for Whitehead, God also has a purpose or a final cause for the generation of the universe in some way, that enters into the generation of the universal process. Okay, so we have a complete new analysis of Aristotle's four causes. Now, let's talk a little bit more about this in detail. So the efficient cause, let's talk about the efficient cause. In Newtonian mechanics, the efficient cause is basically a mathematical gradient, right? I mean, that's how things operate on each other, is through gradients. Gravitation that falls off of the square of the distance, and so forth. But the efficient cause among actual occasions is very different. So if I look, for example, at the way in which the actual occasion that was me an eighth of a second ago is flowing into me, right? I am getting from the occasion I was an eighth of a second ago purposes, thoughts, anticipations, values, feelings, all of that is pouring into me from the past. And that's an example of efficient causation in process thought. Right? So the paradigm of causality in process thought is the relationship between you and the person you were a split second ago. And that's what causality is like. Causality is the reproduction of experience. Causality is the re-experiencing of past experience. Right? Causality and memory collapse into the same thing for process metaphysics. Right? They become the same thing. And they're basically ontologically the same. Now, what that means is that another example of this, you know, we talked about what it's like to deal with actual occasions of different grades, like about holding the glasses, holding a puppy, holding a lover, right? Those different feelings, right? And so those are all, in process theory, efficient causes, right? So that my emotional state right now is an efficient cause of your emotional state right now, a partial determinant. What I'm feeling partially determines what you're feeling, whether you notice it or not, right? It's just like my gravitational field affects you whether you notice it or not. So does my emotional field, right? And so empathy becomes a perfectly natural causal effect in terms of process physics. You don't have to explain it in terms of anything else. It belongs as part of causality. And so does telepathy, right? Because all the propositions that I form in the process of my concrescence are available to you to be experienced whether I speak them or not. Right? Because I, as an actual occasion, am affecting you, and so you are having some re-experience of my experience in every moment. So you see how efficient cause now is not just billiard ball causation, it's also empathic and telepathic. Those become legitimate forms of efficient causation. That makes sense? Okay. Now the formal cause also functions as a kind of efficient cause. And the way that happens, this is not in the current chapter, I added this later, it'll be in the new version I send you, but the formal cause affects the way in which an occasion will be objectified. So, like, I'm taking in lots and lots of information right now, right? But some of it that comes to the surface of my consciousness comes to the surface because it's formally interesting to me, right? So, like, if I'm thinking about a certain philosophical problem, and you say a remark that sort of triggers my thinking process, it will raise what you're saying to a higher priority for me, and so I will objectify it in myself more fully. Or, for example, if you're dating, right? You know that the attraction that people feel for each other has a great deal to do with their formal properties, right? So, you know, if I have the formal properties of a bodybuilder with blonde hair and blue eyes, that would be one thing. And if I have the formal properties of a dwarf with a deformed nose, that'll be something else, right? It has a different effect, and people will objectify me more or less fully depending on my form, right? So the form becomes an element in efficient causation. Now, there are several ways this shows up in modern thought. For example, this begins to explain some of Rupert Sheldrake's idea of morphic resonance. Right? Because morphic resonance would say, let's say that if there's a little stream over here and a little stream over here, because they have a morphic resonance, what happens over here will have some impact over there. Right? So this is a kind of efficient cause mediated by formal resonance. Right, so this is a whole other dimension of causation that Sheldrake has been exploring that fits very nicely into this context of process metaphysics. And then also, in process metaphysics, the final cause functions as efficiently. Right? So that the purpose, first of all, the purpose that informs my existence is a gift. In every moment, I come into being with a purpose. But that purpose precedes my concrescence. It sort of comes into being with the new moment, is a purpose. And this purpose, which I think of as a matrix of values, comes from many sources. And so to begin with, Whitehead says that God, which is who I call the ultimate ordering factor in the book, I do that to emphasize the abstract nature of the description, obviously, right? But anyway, so God provides each occasion with a cause, an initial cause, subjective aim, an aim, a purpose, a subjective aim. So Whitehead says God provides each occasion with a subjective aim. And that subjective aim is at least an aim at maximizing value for itself and in the relevant future. So there's some kind of general aim that's contributed by God. But then also, my aim is fundamentally influenced by the societies to which I belong. Right? So for example, if I feel within myself an evolutionary urge, like we were talking about earlier in response to Caleb's question, that evolutionary urge... I just got lost again. What was I just talking about? My mind's in
subjective aim.
Subjective aim, yeah. So if I feel an evolutionary aim, that comes to me by virtue of my participation in the universe. Right? So that aim is sort of given to me by virtue of the fact that I'm part of the evolution. And then there are other aims. So for example, I have certain philosophical aims, which are unusual in their intensity in me, but they also feel inherited from the past in some way. Right? And then also, each one of us has an individual aim. And any society with personal order begins to form an individual aim. And the way it works is this. At the beginning of each concrescence, there's a certain aim that's given to me by God and the environment. And in the course of my concrescence, I refine and further specify that aim until at the end of my concrescence, I have a specific aim about how I want to influence the future. Right? And that specific aim, which I formulate out of the raw materials of the given aim, gets passed on to my next occasion and to the next occasion. And so through the course of a lifetime, for example, I gradually begin to develop an individualized set of values, which I pass on from member to member of my personality. So this is all about aim, right? Which is a very, very important category in process metaphysics. In fact, the unity of aim is the unity of an actual occasion. That is the core of its unity. It's the expression of a single aim at concrescing the universe.
Is that the personal aspect?
No, that's the general. Well, no, the general, the initial subjective aim. And the way that's shaped, that's the core of a concrescence in a certain way. So what I'm saying is that Whitehead, we'll see this in the next chapter, Whitehead talks about breaking down actual occasions for analytical purposes. And he breaks actual occasions down into prehensions. A new term I'm introducing, right? So an actual occasion for Whitehead is a concrescence of prehensions. What is a prehension? A prehension is a, what I would define is a little bit different from Whitehead, but I would say that a prehension is a lower grade actual occasion that shares my aim. So for example, one way to look at it is that in my body, my cells and organs function as prehensions for me. Right? But what is the unity? What brings the body together as a unity? What makes it one instead of many things? And Whitehead would say that the reason my body is one body is because all of the cells and organs share the same purpose, the same aim. That's what gives them their unity. Right, so for Whitehead, it's a little different. Whitehead talks about the beginning of a concrescence, right? So here I am, there's a past universe, I come into being, and there's all those past actualities. Whitehead would say, I form a prehension of each past actuality. Right? So I have an individual relationship with each one of those things in the past, and that's a prehension. So I have a prehension of every actual occasion making up your bodies, but I also have a prehension of you. Each one of you is a prehension, right? And so I start with causal prehensions. I take you in. I prehend each of you. And then I generate conceptual prehensions. We'll talk about all this next week. But the point is that a concrescence is a concrescence of prehensions, and they're bound together by a common aim at value. That the core of the unity of the person for Whitehead is this aim, the aim, right? The aim to concrest the universe to maximize value. That is what binds it together into a unity. Right? So the aim is a causal factor. What I would say it is that it's the subjective aim of the high-grade personality that I am that influences the aims of all the occasions in my body, so they start to work together and to coordinate their spontaneous decisions for the benefit of the whole. Right? So this idea of aim. Now, another way to look at aim is that we all feel it. We all feel our own sense of purpose. But we're also aware that we can be caught up in someone else's aim. Now, we see this a lot. I mean, just for example, cults are a good example of that, right? Where everybody adopts the aim of a leader. But also, as we form close relationships, we begin to discover that our own individual aim is no longer the same as it used to be. We now have different aims because the purposes of me and the person I'm close to begin to blend into a sort of common aim at value. And if you get a few people together all working on a certain aim, it becomes very contagious, right? And so what I'm trying to say is that purpose and aim is one of the main factors that bind the world together into various interesting unities. And so purpose is actually a form of efficient causation also, right? So whereas everything collapses into the formal cause for Aristotle, it all collapses into the efficient cause for process metaphysics. That's really interesting, right? Because if you go with the formal cause as primary, you end up with isolated entities that are not fundamentally in relation with each other. But when you start with something like actual occasions, which are fundamentally, interdependently originated, then efficient cause has to be the most important one because it's all about relationship. Well, so you make the formal cause the central one, you lose the significance of interdependent origination. But if you centralize on efficient cause, you are able to appreciate the fundamental interconnectedness and interdependencies of things. Yes, Caleb.
So one part of that's becoming unclear for me is separating out. We have these four. So for example, we have the forms, and then we have causation, and then the thing that's being caused. And what I'm starting to do is collapse causation with the form in the formal cause. So form and cause are one thing, and we call it formal cause. But I thought that form was like an idea, and then the causation is the action of the idea that produces some entity. Is that not correct?
I'm not sure. I really appreciate your question, and I can see that my language is a little bit sloppy.
Well, I know. I mean, it's difficult to understand, because then what happens is efficient can be synonymous with causation.
In the modern world, it is.
And that's where the... Yeah, so...
Right, listen, this is confusing. So what I'm saying... I will not... Okay, you said separated out three things. And separating the cause out that way from the form is confusing to me. It may make sense. I'm just having a little trouble following it at this moment. But let me say what's absolutely right about what you're saying. This is not fully clear. It's a little bit funny, right? Because the whole idea of taking formal cause and making it a form of efficient cause, and final cause and making it a form of efficient cause, is a brand new idea that I just came up with. I've been working with it for a while, right? But it's not fully developed. And so the questions you're asking sound appropriate to me and interesting. But I'm telling you, it's sort of as far as I've gotten with it. So your questions could take it further, right? In terms of further analytic.
Well, if we put it back into the house analogy,
yeah,
it's like the blueprint as the form is not, there's a causation that the blueprint has, but the causation is not the blueprint itself.
Right, but in a natural being, it is. Right, like you know, there's so, like it's what Sheldrake would call a morphogenetic field. Right, so the morphogenetic field is a formal field in some.
But synonymous with so the morphogenetic field is synonymous with the intellectual pattern of the thing or the form of the thing.
Yeah.
So as I think in a particular way, that thinking is also a causation of a field that's causing thinking similar,
yeah.
Versus there's a thing of thinking and then there's the causation of it. And that's, I guess, I want to separate. And so, but yeah, okay.
I don't know. Are you saying something interesting that I just a little over my head at this moment? I have to really sit down with you, but it sounds really provocative. It's worth clarifying. I just don't exactly know. Yeah, Bill.
Okay, so I'm struggling also. Not reaching into the ontologics, but so if I get this from the top superficial level, you say efficient cause is like other atoms causing
yeah.
change in this atom. It's the previous causes, or I mean, it's the previous. It's the state of all the objectified expired occasions.
Mm-hmm.
Then if we drop down into a little more detail, you break down the stages of the occasion, and aim becomes really the cause more than, and you know, we got creativity floating around out here too,
yeah.
as a certain kind of an ordering or restriction on the possibilities based on the past. And
that's stuff. Right. That's right.
But let's see. So you had earlier said that. That an occasion was started by the primordial
nature of God.
Whereas in this, what I'm getting is that it's the history plus the component. It's through the aims. It's the history plus the component of the universal aim in your subjective aim that makes up the cause and the prehension, I guess. Right?
Yeah, but see, we don't want to make any one cause the most important. They're always operating.
When collapsed,
what?
What's that?
The collapse is this: it's that in a certain sense, in the functioning of an actual occasion, forms and purposes are causal. In other words, there's two different things. There's the way these causes operate within the functioning of occasions, and the way they operate between occasions. I think I need to clarify that and analyze it out much more. Carefully. This is probably the distinction that will help clarify it, right? So there's a final cause that operates in guiding my concrescence, and there's a formal cause which is my particular array of possibilities and so forth, right? But then I'm saying, so all that's sort of internal to the occasion, but then I'm pointing out that when occasions affect each other, which is fundamentally efficient cause, the form of the occasion and the purpose of the past occasion influence the way in which it affects other occasions. So I'm saying is that formal and final causes operate both within occasions and among occasions.
Right, so that incorporates eternal activity.
Yeah, eternal activity.
Right there, right. Yeah, so you
well, they're definitely part of this, because the form, all form is eternal object. A form is an eternal object.
But there's not a case that there's a gap between this occasion, which is filled in by God says, go this way.
Well, there is a gap between every two occasions, right? So this is very interesting. So whenever an occasion expires, it leaves a universe behind.
Right.
Okay? So there it is. One occasion has expired and there's a universe. Now what's going to happen next? Well, creativity is a statement which says, if there is a universe, it will concrete into a new occasion.
Okay.
Right? That's just a metaphysical proposition. It's an assumption.
Right.
Now the question is, in that universe, okay, so I am, and there's a whole universe that I left behind me, having finished my occasion. that whole universe is going to become a new occasion. That's the hypothesis. That's our fundamental metaphysical hypothesis, is that when one occasion expires, it leaves the universe, and the universe will become a new occasion. This is the bedrock assumption of process metaphysics.
This is the many get increased by one.
Yeah, that's right. Many becoming one would be increased by one. Right. So this is our fundamental move in process metaphysics, that this is what existence is about. Existence is that whenever one occasion ends, it leaves behind the universe, which becomes a new occasion. That's time, that's space, everything is derived from that one recursive operation.
Okay, and in the case that you have a very low grade occasion,
yeah.
Actually you're in quantum mechanics, so it's not Newtonian, but it has little imagination and less choices.
Yeah.
Not actually relative to human imagination, yeah, but I think that's a technicality. I don't get into that. But so, okay, yeah, so then it sort of approximates what you can superficially look at as one thing causing another in a sort of atom to atom way.
Well, no,
because
it's
meant to approximate.
I'm lost. I don't know what you're talking about in terms of where are we going? Where are we coming from?
Yeah, thanks.
Tell you what, it's 1:15. We're going to take a break. You can think about it over break, and we'll start with your question after break. Okay? Well, you're still
learning.
I want to take a couple of questions, then I have an idea for an activity for us. But go ahead, Bill.
Well, I think I'm getting it. Play for the complexity, because on the one hand, anywhere you just come in and say God did it, you know, that's what you say. Doesn't do that for me.
Well, you know that.
But if you break it all down and you've got all these factors involved.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You know, like I noticed in the book, you'll see that I'm often referring to this ultimate ordering factor,
right?
To God, right? Because there are certain elements in the system that require an external input. Right? Now, the thing is this. Then scientists get all bent out of shape, right? But I would point out that scientists make much more use of God than I do. Because scientists never, ever explain who or what does the calculating that determines trajectories.
That's right.
Right, and so I would call that their ultimate ordering factor, or their God. The God is the one who does all the calculating for the scientists. Now, they ignore that, but you see, at least I can explain a lot of the calculations as being part of, in terms of efficient causes and actual occasions and so forth. All I need for God is to provide an initial aim and a position for the occasions. But the scientists need the God to do everything. And then they get, right? So it's just,
how do you mean the position for the occasion? I remember you said that.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is that I was going to this rap, right? So I end my concrescence. And now there's a universe, a whole universe, right, which is going to concress. The question is, what position in that universe will be the center of the concrescence?
Okay.
Right? Now,
so the past history doesn't say where that is?
Well, the past history influences it, but it doesn't necessarily determine it.
Okay. So that is a place where you say God, whatever, comes in and, you know, places the occasion, so it's way different than atom to atom causality.
In that one place it is. Now, I could be wrong about it. I mean, this is something I came up with because I couldn't figure out how an occasion could determine its own position. But subsequently I've thought of ways we could have an occasion determine its own position as well, so I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, that's where that was the particular point. Having trouble because I don't know.
Well, for example, I know this though. So I'm a personally ordered society, and every eighth of a second I expire. And then there's a new universe that has to and has to concrete. Now, usually, thank God, literally, thank God, usually, after I expire, God provides an occasion for me to pour myself into that's right next to me in time and space. Right?
That can't work because they know you actually in that previous step you're talking about.
That's right. No, so I end, And then there's a new universe that's going to concrete, right? So Whitehead says God has to provide the new aim for the occasion. Right? God is somehow involved in precipitating the formation of the occasion.
It's not like he comes over Deus Ex Machina and says, okay, I'm going to put you here and put you there as part of the ordering.
I don't know how to think about it exactly. I mean, it's part of the ordering. Whether God's making conscious choices, I haven't thought about it. I don't exactly know how that works. But the point is, the reason I've been talking about it the way I have, you see, one of the things you need to look at in philosophers is where they're trying to get with their ideas, right? So I'm putting these ideas together in part to explain reincarnation. I've got that in mind, right? And so I'm noticing that as a personally ordered sequence of actual occasions, I always anticipate where I'm going to appear next. I expect to appear again in close proximity to where I just was so that I can have this nice continuity. But sometimes it doesn't happen. Sometimes I might die in between those two occasions, right? Or the world might shift in some way unexpectedly or whatever, right? And so I don't actually fully determine where I will show up next. Now, maybe that's because all the other occasions determine it, or maybe it's because God determines it, and we can play with this.
But there's a liberation in there from domino causality.
That's right. That's right. Because there is certainly, within each process of concrescence, there is a quantum of absolute freedom. So now quantum mechanics acknowledges this by saying that all causality is probabilistic. Right? So you can't actually predict. I'm interpreting that to mean that each occasion as it comes into being has a quantum of absolute freedom, which it exercises within certain limits.
But that's after it already got started.
That's after it got started, that's right. But then there's also, I think, a decision involved in getting it started.
Yeah.
Now, at an earlier stage of... Tell you a little story about Process and Reality. When Whitehead wrote Process and Reality, he decided that he was going to use every word he wrote, no matter what. Right? Because he knew that he was always changing his mind, so he was trying to limit himself, right? So he started writing, and as he was writing, he changed his mind about fundamental issues several times. And so when he'd change his mind, he would go back into what he'd already written and insert a sentence or two to make it seem like it corresponded to what he wanted to say later. But it never did exactly work, right? And so the text is an utter mess. And this guy, Ford, I think, one of those guys, Lewis or Ford, wrote this book called The Development of Whitehead's Metaphysics, in which he used the techniques of biblical exegesis to deconstruct Process and Reality into several different layers with several different metaphysical systems. It's an incredible book. If you like Whitehead, you gotta read that book. One of the beautiful things about it is that you really get to feel how a great metaphysician works. Because when you read that other book, you start to realize Whitehead tried this, and Whitehead tried that, and then he gave up on it, and you begin to feel him hacking out the system. And it's wonderful. Right, and some of the earlier systems are amazing. So one of the earlier systems, he didn't have just concrescence; he had transition and concrescence. Right, so transition was the process going from the universe to the beginning of the occasion, and then at that point, concrescence would start. Right, so this whole area of transition is insufficiently explored.
Okay.
Right. And I would like to see some cosmic freedom in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we're doing metaphysics, we got to play, right?
Yeah, you got to make the structure somehow as coherent as you can.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. Did you answer your question?
Okay. Yeah, that was a different question.
Okay, great. You want to ask it now?
Yes, because it ties in completely if we have time. Well, the way that it's sounding when you're talking about the universe choosing the place for the next occasion and giving it its aim, is there only one occasion happening or concrescing ever at the same time? And
good question.
Is there an overall, like it makes it sound like there's one overall aim for the universe, and then it kind of goes down in a hierarchy of all our individual aims.
Absolutely. Beautiful. Beautiful. Okay. First question was, is there only one happening? And the answer obviously is no. that concrescence is not a pure linear function, because every time any occasion ends, creativity is invoked to create a new occasion. Right, and so obviously lots of these are happening at the same time.
Okay, so the universe is doing this all over the
yeah,
place. Okay,
exactly. No, that's a good question, though, because sometimes you talk about it, it gets a little oversimplified. When I talk about it as a recursive function, it sounds like it's happening one at a time. In the book, I actually mention that. That's an oversimplification. Good question. And your second question was?
Oh, that there's really only one aim, one overall universal aim that kind of filters down.
Yeah, to a certain extent, I think that's true. So, and Whitehead does. So Whitehead would define that aim as the maximization of value. The maximization of experienced value is the overall aim of the creative advance. And then it gets broken down in different ways. So as Sri Aurobindo would say, the universe exists for the sake of bliss, which is a more poetic way of saying the same thing. That's the overall purpose, right? If you want to get that's that.
Final cause.
Yeah, final cause is for bliss, right? Or for value. That is the ultimate final cause, for the experience, for valuable experience. The universe exists for the sake of generating valuable experiences. You know, since the universe is nothing outside of it, it's hard to give it any external purpose. Right? So, but again, you see, I feel very relaxed about this because it's so arbitrary in a certain way, right? We're making up stories, right? Now, the criteria for our stories is, do they work? Do they help explain our lives, and do they enrich our lives? That's our main criteria. Do they lead to the valuable experience? So we can play, right? You know, oh, God this, God that. We can try them out, see how they work, and so forth. Right? Especially at our level. Right? We're graduate students, right? So it's important, right? We are, as graduate students, we are becoming teachers' teachers, right? And so in the Buddhist teachings, there's a distinction between sutra and abhidharma. You guys know about that? So the sutra teachings, the word sutra comes from the same word root as suture, like sewing up, right? And so the sutras are like sewing together the mind of the student with the mind of the teacher. It's popular teaching, right? But abhidharma is when you get into the philosophy of it, trying to figure it all out, reduce it to linear order, right? And of course, the students, sutras, the students that you teach sutra to don't need that. They're looking for a framework they can live in. And if they come to you and you take on the responsibility, you can suggest a framework for them, right? But as a teacher, you have to understand how that structure works, right? And what the metaphysical assumptions are and so forth. So you can have a sense of responsibly teaching it, understanding its limits and being able to play with it because you understand it deeply enough to adapt it to new situations and new students. So we're doing Abhidharma studying here, right? We're studying how to think about spiritual teaching, right? So we can eventually teach, right? So we're going to the deeper levels here. So we can play. We have no allegiance because theoretically for us, we're not dealing with such a heavy psychological burden. And we've reached the point where we can play with ideas. As we're trying to do that, though.
Eric, yeah. Briefly, what might be some, since we're talking about this, some final cause or purpose for us in learning this, like what are some real practical ways we can take this out into, you know, people who aren't going to be metaphysicians but want to, but this can impact their life? What do you think?
Well, I'm not quite sure what your question is, but for example, if I were doing spiritual teaching around this, I would talk about a lot about the cultivation of the personal aim. And I would talk about how the values that we choose to live up to in each moment affect the next moment. And I would talk about that. I would talk about spiritual practice in terms of the cultivation of aim or attitude. That's one way I could apply it. Also, I would talk to people about the radiation of aim and how my purpose affects the purposes of the people around me and what that means. And so the cultivation of group purpose or group aim and what that can do in terms of the world. And so there's all kinds of practical consequences for this. And then also, you can use this to construct a whole spiritual psychology. Right? And I've been doing some work with that. And
you know, talking about choice and awareness and all those things that we all ordinarily talk about, often in spiritual practice, can receive a philosophical grounding in these ideas, which make them more powerful and easier to use out in the world. Yeah.
Well, I have a couple in your description brought to mind. The whole distinction between the teaching for the, you know, the sutra-based teaching, and I believe the term
Abhidharma.
Abhidharma. Mm-hmm. That kind of teaching reminds me of the distinction between what Thomas Kuhn called normal science and extraordinary or revolutionary science.
In a way, this is a much more mundane distinction, but I see what you're getting at.
But to me, what I wonder, and this is the second part of it, is in the integral era, it seems to me that being transparent to all the mutations of consciousness, all the structures of consciousness, requires some sort of deeper philosophical grounding in some way. And I'm kind of thinking this through as I'm talking, and so I'm not quite sure about that. But I've always tried to think, coming from some of my own interests in philosophy, about what it would mean to train people to do extraordinary science, and what it would be like to have everybody have the level of consciousness where they could be trained more in an Abhidharma kind of way than in a sutra kind of way.
Right.
And I don't necessarily have a real question about that, but I just wanted to kind of get some of that out there because it seems like a really interesting area.
It is a very, very interesting area, extremely interesting, because to the extent that we can educate people into a sort of, you know, slightly detached, formal, clear, intellectual stance toward reality, I think we're doing a lot of good. I think that's a really big advance. And I think it's particularly a big advance, a huge advance, when people become able to recognize their own trips as trips. When people become able to recognize their own ideas as just ideas that they've adopted. And people can make the distinction between what they think is real and what's real. There are many cases in which that distinction is very difficult to make. And in particular, if you have an idea and you have never, ever heard it contradicted, it will begin to seem to you so obvious that it's unquestionable. So for example, for 2,000 or 3,000 years after Aristotle, the idea of substance could not be questioned. People just weren't capable of it, right? It just seemed like so obvious that everything had to be a substance that no one even knew how to think it different, right? It wasn't until the 1900s, right, that we began to develop forms of thought that enabled us to separate, right? Now, also in America, most people in America had never heard a critique of capitalism. Not once in their entire life. And so the capitalist view of reality, you know, just seems to be so obvious that people project it all the way back into primitive mentality and so forth, right? People view the whole universe as a competition for free energy, right? Which is a purely capitalist view of the universe, right? So we have to be educated to the point where we can hear alternatives to our ideas and recognize them as valid and then detach. That's partly education, and it's partly spiritual maturity. And it's not clear to me. I think that if we had a better education system, a lot more people would reach that level, but not everybody. And there are other things involved there. It's like one of those cognitive stages beyond formal operations, right? There's some stage where the ideas begin to stand out for themselves instead of just seeming like being identified with reality. Yeah.
Have you read Suzanne Kirkreuter's work?
No.
She has she's from Harvard. She did a dissertation where she expanded on Dane Lovinger's model of ego development.
Uh-huh.
And so she basically articulated two higher stages that basically correspond to integral stages of development. And the highest one she calls construct aware.
Ah.
And it's exactly what you're talking
Beautiful.
About. And it's sort of almost, there's some kind of resonance with the sort of postmodern inside of there's some kind of construct, but it becomes this embodied psychological reality. You sort of see the very stories I'm telling in a very everyday embodied kind of way are construct, my own lived philosophy
That's
is
right.
construct, and I'm seeing that construct coming into being in a recursive
Beautiful.
Flow.
Beautiful.
And I'm questioning it, and I'm working with it with that awareness. So it is a really kind of holistic development that it takes. It's not just a cognitive kind
that's
of
right.
Understanding.
That's right.
And that's such a great question. What would education have to look like to be able to
foster
this kind of development? Right now, the educational system at large, the mainstream educational system, fosters development up to formal operations at best.
Beautiful, Nick. That's really well said. I'd like to get that reference too.
Yes.
I'd like to see
interesting work, Suzanne Cook-Greuter.
Can you email that to me?
Sure. Yeah.
Because I'm interested in her description of that stage. Something I've been keep trying to talk about. To hear her description of it.
It's really cool, and it's all grounded in real research.
Excellent.
It's
cool. Yeah.
So when you think, is the concrescence of thinking the patterns of neurons in your brain, and then those create. Apprehensions into your next thought? Is that a bad...
I just don't know. Caleb, you're asking me these questions that are really interesting, but I would need a long time to think about them.
I'm thinking that the concrescence, the physical connection between the thoughts...
Well, if we take Eric's move and we regard the neurons as prehensions of the personality, then I think what you're saying will make sense. But I have to spend more time with it. It's like your questions all seem really interesting to me, but we're coming from such different places that I feel like we need more time to sort of sort them out.
I'm thinking of the practical causation of thinking, like literally thinking, like the thoughts that you think and control in your head,
right.
and how they actually affect other people or yourself.
Right. I think that a lot of my thinking is not really tied to neurons at all, for one thing. I think the majority of it doesn't happen in the neurons. I think of the neurons as being low-grade intelligences that help interpret the physical world into a form that I can deal with and help translate my propositions into actions that can affect the physical world, but that most of my thinking happens in the transphysical worlds outside of the body, but it's still causally effective. That's how I would think of it.
Well, then it'd be even more causally effective if it's transphysical.
That's right. That's
it'd be
right.
more causally effective of others.
That's
my
exactly.
actual thoughts would have more of an impact.
That's it. Exactly.
I'm sorry if I'm thinking in a way that's
No, I really appreciate it.
For
I'm just apologizing because I can't always respond to your questions, but what you just said, that I totally got. Yeah.
Well, that would be a reason why these things are very useful and practical for all people.
That is, you get to understand the causal effects of our thoughts. For
yeah,
example.
If they really affect the world, your thoughts really do affect the world.
Exactly, and see, part of I would say is that the thoughts have a greater causal effect because in the mental world, we're all essentially in proximity, right? And so I can have a direct effect on your mind, no matter where I am geographically. So for example, one of the most practical things that I've discovered, I use this in my life all the time. If I'm having a difficult situation with somebody. I will carry on a deep conversation with them in my own mind, right? And I'll really talk to them, and I'll listen and everything, you know? And when I do that and spend the time at it, the next time I talk to that person, it's as if we already had the conversation. Like, they'll come in as if we had the conversation, now they're at the end of it with me, right? It's amazing how well that works regularly. Right? We can actually enter into a telepathic rapport with people and work problems out. If we do it sensitively, it's tricky. Because if we project their responses onto them, then the whole conversation just somehow doesn't do a thing at all, right? But if we approach it internally with the right degree of receptivity, it really happens. It's an actual telepathic rapport that we can establish with people. And they won't hear our thoughts or anything, right? It's happening way below the level of consciousness. But if I do this, about 90% of the time, it's causally efficacious. It's remarkable how effective it is, right? So this is an example of how this causal analysis has practical effects. Yes, Bill, last question. I want you to show you something else.
Yeah, yeah. From a spiritual point of view, I believe that's a stage, well, in enlightenment or realization, you realize you are everybody, can actually feel, you can, I guess you can have more clarity than you're talking about. You can actually see the field of connection and in this telepathic communication.
Yeah, exactly. I think, I'm sorry, I don't understand your question, but I just haven't followed you.
It's not a question, it's just a, okay. Comment.
That we can, yeah. Okay. So here's what I want to try. I'm finished lecturing today, and you guys have asked a lot of questions, and so I'd like to try breaking up into small groups, and I want to try a specific experiment. The last time we broke into small groups, I think it was a waste of time, because what happened was everybody got in small groups and just started chatting. Right? Because what happens is we'll start to have a philosophical conversation, and it's hard, and then something will come up that's easier, and then we'll talk about that, right? And so I want to break up into small groups again, but I want us to focus on the quality of a philosophical conversation. Now, what that means is that in a philosophical conversation, you start with a question, and you stay with the question until you reach some kind of stopping point, either because you've exhausted your possibilities, or you can't think of anything else, or because you reached a conclusion, or because you decide you have to change the subject because some other subject is more important. But the point is that you start with a topic and you stay with it until you deliberately change it. And if you don't have anything to say on that subject, you don't say anything. Right? So you don't let the conversation get distracted. Right? So I want you to experiment with that. Right? So we'll break up into groups of four. And what if we just said, let's have a discussion about the nature of causality. And then somebody can start with a question or a comment about the nature of causality. You can go from there. But the thing is, I want you to see if you can stick to the subject. And not speak if you don't have anything to say about that subject. But don't go off onto something else just because it's entertaining or because you know something about it. Stay with the subject of the conversation. If you're quiet, that's fine. Right? If you're quiet for a long time, somebody should say, maybe we need a new subject. Right? But don't just gossip. Don't just go off into something easy. But stay with the topic of causality. And then if all of you just together, all four of you decide that before you can talk about causality, you can talk about consciousness, make that decision and then do it. Right? But then all do it together and stay with your subject. So the quality of a philosophical subject is that it begins, a philosophical conversation, is that it begins with the subject matter and it stays with that subject matter until there's a conscious decision to shift it. Okay? So let's experiment with that and see how that works. And so break up into groups of four and let's take 15 minutes. Well, let's do it popcorn fashion. So if you want to respond to somebody, look around, make sure it's okay, and respond, right? So let's see if we can get a big conversation going now in which all of you can creatively participate as long as we do it considerately. If there's any log jams, I'll step in. But let's see what we can do just talking to each other in this big circle. Now that we're all sort of keyed up and have new ideas that we're circulating. So somebody might start by saying what they were talking about and what issues, what questions came up during the discussion.
Well, I guess where we were realizing is that when it comes to actual examples within this format of process philosophy, that we're having a hard time putting it in context. Like, so we were using the idea of making a baby. So the material cause would be, I guess where I was struggling is, you could have a material cause that goes back for infinity, it feels like. Like the creative process, basically, you could say, okay, well, the material cause of having a baby was when the thought to have a baby occurred. Well, then the thought occurred.
That would be the efficient cause.
That would be the efficient
cause. That would be an efficient cause, right? The decision to have a baby would be an efficient cause, not a material cause.
So then what would be the material cause of having a baby?
The material cause would be the mother's body and the sperm, I suppose.
But isn't that taking us into Newtonian?
Well, wait, here's the thing. So, wait, does anybody else want to talk about this? What do you guys, how do you guys do this in your conversation? Right? Where are you guys going with this?
Well, one thing that we were having a problem with is using the term material.
Yeah.
Right.
In process philosophy, like material cause in process
right.
philosophy.
That is clearly a valid point.
Yeah.
The reason I stayed with the word material cause is because I want to establish historical continuity with
right.
Aristotle.
And that was throwing us off.
Right.
Okay, but the analogy still holds. creativity is the fundamental stuff, the fundamental basis of things, right?
I figured the material that was causing was the previous occasions.
No.
So that's not...
That's the efficient.
The previous occasions.
Oh, the efficient cause.
So the material cause is the actual occasion.
The material cause is creativity. Right? So if you think about an Aristotle, the material cause is substance, right? It's sort of what things are made out of. It's that in which qualities inhere. The material cause is that in which qualities inhere. Right? Now, in process thought, there is no stuff in which qualities cohere. Rather, concrescences are processes of associating qualities together. They're a process of association. But there's no substance there. And then once they're finished, they become objectively immortal, right? So they're sort of vaguely substance-like. But the point is that the creativity is what things emerge out of moment to moment. Where does our consciousness come from right now? Yeah, there was a past, sure. And the past, by its efficient nature, is conditioning this moment. But the past doesn't cause this moment. This moment arises out of a ground. What's that ground?
Well, doesn't a house, isn't it a society of processes? And those processes are like bricks and wood and nails?
No. Bricks and wood and nails are not processes. They're societies of actual... I guess they're in some sense they're processes. I guess they are. Okay.
They're the sub-societies that make up the society of the house. In that sense, I was thinking they're the material cause of the house. The sub-processes are materially causation of the objective process that we want to talk about.
Okay, so I can see there's a lot of confusion here that I didn't realize was here. And that...
But in that sense, it sounds like lower order occasions are the material.
But that's not
causes
the case.
For higher order.
No. See, I guess the problem here is that I'm using this word material cause in several different contexts with several different meanings that I have not distinguished in my mind. Okay, so one of them is, like, you talk about the house, then what you're saying makes total sense, right? It's the stuff that it's made out of, but that stuff is obviously other process, right? So you can go that way on that analogy. But if we look at the analogy of an organism, and I wouldn't want to say that the material cause are the cells or the molecules, right? Because what are they made out of? You see, right? So then we have to go down lower and lower,
so
right? So same thing with Aristotle, right? Anything that has a form isn't the substance. So you're looking for the ultimate substance that doesn't have a form, because it is that which is form. That's the point of the material cause. It's that which is formed, right? And so it's formless for Aristotle, and it's also formless for Whitehead. Because for Whitehead, it's the process of concrescence, right? That the creativity pulling the universe, it's creativity itself. That's the material cause. The word material is totally misleading here. You're absolutely right, Chris. I really had not appreciated that, and it's clearly true. So I guess we mean something other than material. We mean something like the ultimate source or the unconditioned actuality at the base of things. Something like that.
The foundational cause.
The foundational cause, something like that, right? So it's a deeper notion. And when it applies to a manufactured thing, the material cause would be other processes, like you say, but when it applies to an actual occasion, the material cause has no form. It's just creativity itself. It's just that which moves through the form, that which operates on the form.
You mean like when we talked about like a computer, just parts that are externally related,
right?
They don't have an internal aim,
right?
But the internal aim of all things would be the material cause of the living.
Not the final cause. The final cause is the purpose. The material cause is the basic operation that gives rise to finite entities in the first place.
It seems like creativity is the basic metaphysical process of the universe.
That's it.
And the actual occasion makes it unique.
That's right.
In its own way.
That's exactly right.
So, like, the creativity is there before the actual occasion.
That's right.
And through the actual occasion.
That's right.
So the actual occasion kind of creates the form of creativity in its own unique.
The actual occasion, as an operation of creativity, becomes characterized by form. Does that make some sense?
Could you repeat that phrase? The actual occasion as an operation of creativity becomes characterized by form?
That's exactly right. So creativity is that process which chooses which forms will become part of the actual world.
That seems efficient, though.
Well, you know, it becomes clear the more we talk about this that these separations are kind of loose, right? So they're useful distinctions, but when we start to look into that, Whitehead says nature presents clear discriminations, which she then withholds upon closer examination. Right? And so, you know, these four causes are analytically useful, but when you start really getting into them, they start to look like each other in certain ways, right? So. But the basic point is that the efficient cause is coming from the past. That's the basic point. It's the way the past conditions the present. The creativity is that which gives rise to a new presence.
I just noticed something that seems interesting to me when we're talking about this. It says your creativity chooses forms according to its aims. So the aims of the occasion are actually the final cause, yet creativity has its own aim. So is that aim aligned with all the final causes of that?
You know, this is really interesting. Yeah. And this is so embarrassing to me. I never realized my words would be read this carefully. You know? I don't think it's actually right for me to have said creativity has an aim. At this moment, it doesn't sound right to me. Because for Whitehead, God provides the aims, not creativity. So
but
I'm not sure what
it chooses, though, right?
What
does it choose according to
somebody else? It chooses which eternal objects that will characterize it.
Based on what maximizes complexity.
Right, and therefore, there's no conquest without an aim. But the question is whether the creativity contributes the aim. I think in my book I said it did. I think I suggested that creativity contributes the aim at concrescence, which is probably valid. But the point is, what I really want to emphasize to you is how we're playing, right? It's like, you know, we try to get this stuff straight, and then when we look at it together, suddenly I can see, oh, I should have said it that way, right? I want you to feel that we're all working on this together, right? And so you can feel free to look at my words and see where they don't make sense and tell me that. I want you to feel that kind of power because important. Yeah. Yeah.
Is the aim of a cause an effect? And if
is the aim
so,
what?
Is the aim of a cause an effect?
Aim? What do you think? How could the aim of a cause be an effect? I don't know what you mean.
Well,
what
so far as
cause?
Like there's a cause and effect relationship, the aim would be post-cause.
So if the aim is carried out properly, the effect should ensue from the cause. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, and if it's a true relationship of necessity, then you can't actually distinguish the two.
But again, there's an if in there. So the aim is just the aim, and only if it is carried out does it become equivalent to the effect.
What does it mean? What does it mean to say the aim of a cause?
Well, we said that the final cause is the purpose of the thing, or it's the aim.
Yeah.
So, final cause is the aim of the thing. That sounds to me like saying that an effect is the cause of something.
I'm completely lost.
That's collapse. See, we had this problem in our discussion, too. I think what you're doing is when you're saying cause, you're thinking efficient cause. Because that's what we tend to do. We tend to collapse it. Mm-hmm. And so, and again, we had some of that going on in our conversation too. It seems to me like the aim is the aim. And if the aim is carried out through the operation of this assemblage of causes, the effect will be resonant, consonant, consistent
right.
with the aim, but it's not.
But
it's,
there's
not,
always that necessity. Like, where is it an experience that an effect is actually just a possibility, where it doesn't have to be the effect of a particular cause, where it's not necessary?
In a process metaphysics, I think that the cause and the effect are rarely connected by absolute necessity. They aren't even connected that way in science anymore, right? Because there's no...
Isn't that what coherence is?
What?
No,
you see, in science, I understand it now with probability theory, right? There's a cause, but the effect cannot be determined until after the effect has been achieved, right? So,
yeah.
So in a new quantum particle, there's a million causes, an infinite number of causes.
And
right?
Why does it collapse to a certain effect is the same
because
question
of the freedom of the occasion. See, the occasion chooses which of the possibilities that are available to it, given all those causes, it will choose which ones to characterize it.
According to its aim.
According to its aim, right? But again, there's freedom. The aim allows us to assign differential values to different outcomes. Without an aim, there would be no way to differentiate the different outcomes. Right? So the aim is what makes the choice meaningful. But the choice remains free.
Because you could say, I want this to happen, and actually it doesn't.
It
Something
doesn't,
else
exactly,
happens.
Exactly.
And so now you're like, that kind of sucks.
Right.
The meaning goes down.
A cause is just a determining factor. But the cause does not have to have any given outcome, because there's a certain freedom in each actual occasion to interpret the past and to choose things on its own.
It has to have a outcome.
It has to have a outcome. If it becomes actual, that's its outcome. The outcome
that's
of
frozen.
What?
That's like, what's the term you use for that? But
Vector immortality, expiration.
Yeah, it's immortal.
At
it's immortalized. Once it's done.
That
but
means
it's like,
it was always collapsed that way.
That's no, it doesn't. It
that's
doesn't.
Only looking backwards.
I don't understand why you're saying that.
It's non-deterministic. It's non-deterministic, though. Okay. See, the classical physics is deterministic. Quantum physics and process philosophy are non-deterministic
right.
to at least an extent.
That's
at
right.
the very least to an extent.
That's right.
Should we just take an example?
We can say that.
Comes to mind, it's just kind of silly, but say that my aim is to wear a bright color, and one of the efficient causes is because it's a really drab day outside.
Yeah, that's good.
And there's lots of choices, lots of bright colors, and somehow the creativity comes in and chooses bright orange.
Nice. That's
and
good. That's
so it's
good.
Not determined. There's a range of possibilities.
That's right. Nice. But you see, the determining conditions may have determined your intention to wear a bright color, let's say, right? But not the color that you'll choose.
Right.
Did the color choose you?
To
say that we chose the color is to
what, Michael? Say we chose the color?
I think to say that I chose the color and I was the agent throughout that story is to create this moment where I can go two separate ways.
That's correct. And there is, and that's what process philosophy does. There are moments of freedom in which we choose how reality will be after us. And we are agents. Now, we could try to reduce our agency to divine agency the way Sri Aurobindo does or not. But the fact is that in pragmatic terms, we exercise agency. And our agency determines causal outcomes.
And every cause has that power, right?
Every cause has what?
And every cause has that freedom.
I know what you mean by a cause. You see, I can't talk about cause in the abstract. Right? Every actual occasion has power. But say a cause has power. I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Didn't you just say that a few minutes? What did you say had this freedom?
The actual occasion has the freedom, as a whole.
So in a sense, it sounds like there are to use the Aristotelian terms, which may be shaky in this context. There are material, efficient, formal, and final causes ingredient in any particular actual occasion.
Yes.
Right.
I'm constituted
by. By those four types of cause, but then I am not equal to those causes because I'm an actual occasion.
Beautiful.
And now I have choice.
That's
so it's chocolate, vanilla, choose.
That's right.
Vanilla.
Okay.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Isn't every cause either an actual occasion or an expired actual occasion?
Yes. All causes in process philosophy are actual occasions.
Right.
And therefore, there is no automatic following of cause and effect. In other words, in between any cause and any effect, there stands the freedom of an actual occasion.
So the freedom comes between you being an actual occasion and then becoming a cause for other actual occasions?
No. I become actual, and you have a choice about how you're going to deal with that.
But then I become a cause.
And then you become a cause, right? And so the freedom only exists in the present moment.
Right. Between my becoming a cause and...
That's right. Between you being cause and you becoming a cause.
I'm pressing into an actual game.
Between you being cause and you becoming a cause,
there's freedom.
There's freedom. Okay. And so therefore there is never an automatic connection between cause and effect.
So we're not billiard balls.
We're not billiard balls, right? There's freedom built in at every level.
We forget in the billiard ball. Well, you just said that every cause is an actual occasion. Did you mean every actual occasion is a cause?
No. According to Whitehead's ontological principle, if you want to explain something, why something is one way rather than another, which is what causes do, you have to refer to an actual occasion to do it.
So the realm of ideas are causes.
Well, yeah, they're causal in a certain way.
And they're actual occasions, too.
No, they are not.
They're possibilities.
So, they're possibilities.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. There's an example where...
But they're not actual occasions, because an actual occasion is just like you. An actual occasion is a concrescence. It's a coming together of the past and a decision about the future. All of that is an actual occasion.
But are they causes?
What?
Are they causes?
Or what causes?
Or is an idea a cause?
Well, it's a formal cause, I guess. Yeah.
So formal causes, actually, I was wrong. I was saying that... There are, I don't know, maybe how I said it was right, but my assumption when I was saying it was that a formal cause is also an actual occasion.
No.
And that's not correct.
That's not correct.
So
not
three out of four of the causes are actual occasions, but the formal causes are not actual occasions. Or...
Well, look at this. Eternal objects are factors in concrescence.
Right.
And as such, they may have a causal role, but they're not agents in any way. They're passive, essentially. They may function as lures, but they don't do anything. Right? So they aren't active causes. And they don't explain anything. You can't explain anything by referring to an eternal object. You can only explain things by referring to actual occasions. Because eternal objects don't make decisions, and therefore can't explain why things are one way rather than another.
Is aim a cause?
That's
what I was asking. Aim is the final cause.
But, yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. So not all causes are actual occasions. All actual occasions are causes, but not all causes are actual occasions. So we have some other types of causes.
Yeah. So there's two different ways. So Whitehead does articulate this ontological principle. And he says that if you want to explain why something is one way rather than another, you have to refer to an actual occasion to explain that. And so there's a special causal role there. However, as we've seen, eternal objects and other actual occasions, they are kinds of causes. Right? So at the end of this conversation, you've all left me really confused.
Good, because when we started it, we were confused.
Right, now I'm confused. Right?
So, the resonance?
So here's my invitation to you. I mean, obviously, this whole business about causation is really subtle and tricky, right? I've offered a certain clarification, which I think does have some usefulness, but clearly it's not adequate. So I'm going to challenge you guys to write papers and make it better, and then I'll include them in the next edition of the book. Right? So, you know, like, we need more clarification here about different kinds of causation. How does causation function in the context of concrescence? How does causation function between concrescences? I now realize that I should have separated those two out, and that would help. There may be other distinctions that need to be made here that I'm learning from you. So I'll have to think about this a lot. So, but I do think there is value in the way I present it. I do think it opens up a new avenue of exploration. But clearly it needs more clarification. And I thank you for alerting me to this need through your questions. All right? Okay, so it turned out we didn't have a round discussion because you were asking me questions that I had to clarify because I had been confusing. So, but I do want to say that in walking around, I was absolutely delighted. It was totally different from last time. And it really, how do you guys feel about it? Great. So we'll do more of that. Now he's figured out how to do it, so we'll do more of that.
That's our first small group.
Yeah.
What?
That was our first small group.
Oh, yes. Maybe last semester.
It must have been last semester I did one that totally bombed. So I'm learning. Okay. Great. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.